Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. This is going to be one of those weird and wonderful Fridays on the show. You're going to meet some amazingly wonderful creatures over the next couple of hours, from Bill of the Sea to a Pegamallow and a Praying Beatus and possibly even some BHS twirlers. Strap in for a wild and exciting ride on Vermont Viewpoint today. Let's start with Bill of the Sea. We mentioned Bill on WDEV when every once in a while our freezer mysteriously gets stocked with plump, succulent scallops. You say scallop, I say scallop, however you pronounce it. They are a true gift from the ocean. Bill is Bill Amaru, who is a generous, hardworking individual who has an amazing story, and we're going to hear it this half hour. Bill, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Rick. It's great to be here. Kind of a dream come true for me.
Well, I hope I don't make it a nightmare.
We won't do that.
All right. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Bill about life as a commercial fisherman or anything else, you can give us a call, 244-1777. Our toll-free number is 877-291-8255. That's 877-291-TALK. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Bill, I usually start at the beginning and work forward, or with you, I'm going to start at the present and work backwards or something like that. So tell us about what you do in the commercial fishing business.
Well, okay, we'll start from here and go backwards. It's a 50-year trip. I'm sort of in a state of semi-retirement. I'll never leave the water. I just have to be out at sea from time to time. So, but my bigger boat, the boat that I historically fished for a living, is now run by my son, who's a third-generation fisherman. He went to the Maritime Academy in Massachusetts, went to sea for a while on ships, and now he runs the fishing boat. And I, as a semi-retired fisherman and sometime forester, spend my time out in good weather on a 36-foot boat, and I do some scalloping with that smaller boat in inshore waters, and I also go mackerel fishing, which we provide bait for the lobstermen in Provincetown and Chatham. Mackerel is very good bait for lobster, and also for human consumption on the days when the market pays enough. Mackerel is an abundant and relatively inexpensive fish. So that's what I do, and I spend as much time up in the country at the cabin in East Corinth that my wife and I built 20 years ago.
I love
after purchasing some land. That was a long a dream. We waited a long time to finally fulfill, and it took us a couple of years, but we put it together, had some help from the local talent in the area, and we now own that cabin, and we spend a little bit of time, get 60 acres of forests and fields, and I'm trying to nurture along some hardwoods, and maybe we'll get a crop someday. I realize, though, after I get started doing that, I'd have to live to be 150 before I get to my first harvest. So I have a ways to go.
Well, you seem like a healthy guy, and you work hard, so maybe you'll make it to that. Where is your boat? Where do you go out of, Bill?
Okay, well, historically, our home harbor has been Chatham, right there on the corner elbow of the Cape, facing to the east. We're way out, as far out as you can go to the east. And our fishing grounds are east of Cape Cod. Actually, we go all the way up to Georges Bank. It's about 100 miles to the east. We fish the waters south of the Cape. Those waters are called Nantucket Shoals. That's east of the island in Nantucket. And then we go up to the north, fishing in the Gulf of Maine. These boats travel, but we go, well, the bigger boat does anyway. We go a long way from time to time, depending on the season of the year, the weather, and where the fish and the scallops are. So that's our home port, but we also fish. I fish out of Provincetown from time to time. I fish out of Hyannis during certain times of the year. You know, but the fish move around, and you've got to kind of stay with them. These are not real big, what we call trip boats, that you stay out for a week at a time in. Those boats can usually home port in one harbor and just maintain that is their home base, and then travel, and they'll be out for weeks at a time.
You mentioned that your son is third generation, so that would have meant your father started this. So how far back does it go in the family?
Well, my dad was always a man of the sea. He actually didn't fish commercially, but we always had boats. We were raised on the Cape. taught me my earliest lessons on the water. And I tell people kind of an interesting story. When I was about 5 or 6 years old, we would go down to the mill pond. That's our saltwater embayment. And we would fish for flounder, blackback flounder, or winter flounder, they're called also. And I felt kind of bad about killing these fish, and off as a little kid. And he used to tell me, I remember him telling me this story, he says, well, if the only way these fish can never get to heaven is if someone catches them, and that's how their soul will eventually get to heaven. And I felt a little bit better about it at that point, and didn't realize that I was going to be ending up sending fish to heaven for the rest of my life. That's what I've done.
Of course, Bill, this assumes that you're going to go to heaven, so I hope you lived a good life for those flounder.
We'll see. I'll give you a report when I find out.
All right. Oh, wow. So your scallops are absolutely delicious. Are they sold under a specific brand, or do you sell them to other companies or restaurants?
Well, you know, that's been evolving. You know, in the past, going back like 20, 30 years ago, the fish, the volume of fish that was coming in, and the level of appreciation of quality seafood wasn't anything like it is today. Fish, you probably don't even know this because not from the coast, but fish was sort of the poor man's meal many years ago. And I remember being raised as a Catholic. We would have fish on Friday. I wasn't particularly enamored of that. But then a little at a time, it sort of evolved during the 70s and 80s with the move towards healthier eating. Fish began to become rather more appreciated, with the high levels of omega fatty acids that it has. And the chef down in Louisiana, he kind of got it all going. What was his name? And he had that blackened redfish.
Was it? It wasn't Emerald. It was the guy before him, the older guy with the mustache. Yep.
Right, and he had a French name.
Yep.
And that really got people kind of clicked into fish, and it's been going up since. So what we do, our scallops are carefully handled, and we have an ice-making machine on board the boat. So we have plenty of ice. We keep our product extremely cold, which is very important, even for the consumer to remember. Fish isn't like chicken or pork or beef. It wants to stay very, very cold. I always tell people when I sell them product to put it in the very lowest part of the refrigerator, because that's usually the coldest part. That way, keeping it fresh. So we do that. We keep them well iced. We keep them in a brine, a chilled brine solution. When we get in, we transfer them immediately to the wholesaler, and then the wholesaler is the one who handles the final sale. He does have a retail store, and then the rest of the scallops are sold literally around the world. They air freight them all over the world.
Mm. Wow. Bill, we've got a call from another Bill in South Woodbury. Bill, the caller, go right ahead.
Well, I grew up in Sag Harbor, down in Long Island.
Oh, my gosh.
And, in the old days, I could go, it was, in speaking of blocks, it was about 2 blocks away from my house was Long Beach. And you could go there with just your feet and, you know, pop up the clams and stuff. But we'd go scalloping, you know, quite a bit. And I was down there for Christmas, and although I didn't go scalloping then, they had some sort of a blight in the scallops down there, and for the bay scallops, and it cost me almost $60 a pound when I got them at Stewart Seafood, and I'm against it. So I was wondering, up yonder in Massachusetts from there, what it was, did you have that blight, or?
No, we didn't. We were one of the lucky areas that hasn't suffered from the blight. You're Connecticut and Long Island scallops are really in a bad way right now, and this blight is connected to the lowering water quality, oxygen depletions because of high levels of nitrogen in the water that causes algal blooms, and the algal mass dies, goes to the bottom, it consumes a lot of oxygen and decomposition, and you end up with these terrible blights that destroy. These are sensitive animals. You're talking about bay scallops, and I was talking about sea scallops, but we do both. My smaller boat goes for bays. And yes, the prices were extraordinary, although I never heard 60. We, as fishermen this year, if we cut our own scallops, we were getting $24 a pound. That's the most we've ever gotten. In the shell, we sell them for about $2.50 a pound. Of course, then they're paying us for the weight of the shell and the meats. But the prices have been astronomical, and they remain, it's always what the market will bear. It's just like in anything, in beef or even in milk. If the supply is low and the demand is high, the prices will go up.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish that would happen for the dairy farmers of Vermont, but we don't see that too much anymore. But that's what it needs to be. And we have a very low supply, like the gentleman Bill just said. Hardly anything came out of those waters more to the west and south of us, where they used to have really healthy fisheries.
Well, that's sad to hear. The chef that we were trying to think of, Bill, was Justin Wilson. Yeah, who kind of got blackened fish really popular. And
I remember another one. His name was Paul Prudhomme.
Oh, Paul Prudhomme. Yeah, that's right. He was another down there, So take us through a day out, you know, being out there on a catch.
Okay, well, we leave early in the morning. I mean, like 1 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock. Did that my whole life, which is one of the reasons I'm listening to you guys early in the morning, because I'm up. I can't get out of the habit after 45 years of these hours. So we leave early in the morning, and that gives us a chance to get out on the grounds. It takes us about 3 hours to steam to where we're going now on east of the Cape for our scalloping. And first light, we leave a little earlier in the summer because the first light comes so much earlier. Mm-hmm. And we fish during the day, depending on the circumstances of the tide and the time and the price and a whole lot of other things. We might stay out overnight, but generally we try to make it in by evening of that day. And we'll be unloaded and done with the boat, tie her up around 6. Go home, grab a shower, and bite to eat, and a few hours of sleep, and back on the boat again. That's the way the summer schedule works. In the wintertime, when the weather is windy like it is today, both here and up where you are, we just go by the wind. When it drops off, we sail. And when the wind picks up, we head home.
Hmm. And how do you catch a scallop? I mean,
You use a dredge. You use a big metal. The farmers would be familiar with this because they understand moving steel over the ground. And basically, we move it over the ocean floor. It's a big metal frame with a chain bag behind it. And this is a chain and links of metal, which you make by hand. You take the links and you take the rings and you link them together. And it makes a flexible metal bag that drags along and collects the scallops as it goes across the bottom. And scallops are amazing animals. They actually swim. They'll get up when they sense a dredge coming towards them. We've got videotapes of this stuff. they actually flip up into the water column, and they'll get right out of the way of the dredge. So they're quite clever.
Yeah. Bill, being a fisherman, is it fun, exhilarating, dangerous?
All three.
Wow.
All three. Yeah, well, it has to be fun because physically it can be pretty demanding, and if you don't enjoy what you do, it would be torture. And, yeah, I mean, the ocean isn't calm all the time. You get up in the morning and you hope the hell the wind isn't blowing, but if it is and you've got to go, you sail anyway, and you can get pounded around. These are fairly small boats. Everybody's seen the Alaskan crab fishery.
The catch, yeah, dangerous catch.
Yeah, the most dangerous catch, yeah. That is a good example of what it can be like. Of course, we're in smaller boats. We don't go out in weather like those fellas will fish in, and those larger, almost those things are almost ships. Yeah, but it can be fun. I've enjoyed it. I felt as though I never went to work my entire career as a fisherman because I was having so much fun doing it. It was a wonderful opportunity. And, you know, one of the things I wanted to mention before we end our conversation is that the fishing industry has taken a lot of raps over the years for the decline in our resource out at sea. And management over the years has been a challenge, and it remains a challenge. But we've come a long, long way. And one of the things that I was lucky enough to be able to participate in was in management. I was a member of the New England Fishery Management Council for 9 years I served. And we put together the fisheries management plans that keep the stocks from going completely overfished, because they could be with the amount of power that the fleet has today in modern electronics, making it possible for us to fish accurately wherever we want to go. But under the current conditions, the rules and regulations do not allow overfishing. We have scientific definitions which define what we consider a rebuilt stock or an overutilized stocks, and we stick to the law on these. And as a result, most of our stocks are doing better. Some of them are at record high levels. Haddock is one of them. Scallops, incredibly abundant. It's the most valuable fishery in the world today, the New England scallop fishery, worth many, many billions of dollars annually. And it's sustainable. It goes on. As long as you take care of the resource and the waters are good, you have a continuous supply. It's just amazing. It's like a forest, except it grows so much faster. You know, we get a crop in 7 years.
Right.
Where it takes 70 for the forest. But harder to manage than a forest for sure, because you can't count the scallops or the fish. They're difficult to get an idea of how much is there, but we do get pretty good ideas from sampling. We have commercial and scientific ships that go out and sample and get an idea of what the stocks look like, and that's how we set our quotas, and we stay within those quota limits.
Wow. Well, I want to get into a couple other things. You're a very interesting person, and you do woodworking as well, right?
Yeah, well, I get a lot of time off.
Yeah.
As, you know, not having the big boat to go out to sea anymore. And so, yeah, I built a cabin with some help. Obviously, I'm not a builder, but we got the cabin outside all built and assembled, and then I did the interior, and I learned as I went, and I had some wood left over. So I started building the furniture for the cabin, and that one thing led to another, and back down here on the Cape, I built a little wood shop that was using my garage for a while, and it was messy and dirty and didn't have any place to put anything but my woodworking tools. So I built the shop, and, yeah, that's what I do now. I go in there. I get wood right from the show. In fact, I just purchased some, cherry, but it turned out to be honey locust, and I'm using it right now in the shop to build a set of bunk beds, two sets of bunk beds that will go into a room we're going to expand in the basement so we have a little bit more space for the grandkids. And, I'm just getting to the point where I'm putting the finishing touches on these two sets of bunk beds. And I bought other wood. I always listen to the fellows. They come on from time to time. You had a fellow on a couple of weeks ago.
Yep.
I forget what he had exactly, but it sounded interesting.
Well, Bill, I also want to ask you about your artistic side. You were a symphonic clarinet player, so tell us about that.
Yeah, well, in a previous century, literally, seems like a century ago. Yeah, my musical education was in clarinet performance. I went to school, and I listened to Joel in the morning. He's even mentioned some of the teachers that I've had on. He's such a musicologist
with
an incredible amount of knowledge. And one day he was talking about a pianist who he was playing a performance by, and it happened to be the piano instructor I had back at Albany State. I went to school in Albany, New York. Yeah, so I played a couple of years as a journeyman clarinetist in Boston and in Albany and here on the Cape. But I always kept my hand in the water. You know, I was going hand lining for cod back in those days before I was doing any scalloping or anything. We were just hand lining, and that's how we caught most of our fish in those days. And I was making more money on a day at sea hand lining cod out of my skiff than I was making for a concert. So we had a family earlier than we planned, and one thing led to another, and fishing turned out to be the way we put food on the table, so that's how that happened.
All right. We had a caller who asked if you're getting sea or bay scallops, and you get both, but mostly sea scallops, correct?
Yes. The bay scallops is something that I do in the bay waters that's close to shore. We're right inside close to the shoreline. We can see the steeple on the church from where we're fishing. Mm. Whereas with the ocean or sea scallops, he's going 100 miles from time to time or a little closer. Right now he's fishing about 20 to 30 miles out.
Mm. And also want to know where she can get your scallops.
Well, I do have a little thing that I do for people, except that unless she's in Orleans or somewhere on the Cape, I the only other thing I can do is freeze them, and like I did for you guys, and bring them up in 1 pound or 2 pound Ziploc bags. They're about as good as you can get.
Yeah. Well, I'll have, she's off the line, but she emails vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com, I'll try to get you and her hooked up and see what happens. Bill, when you're out there, you're pulling up, your take from the sea, any surprises that you get in your, is it nets or cages?
Well, when we're fishing, we use a net. And that is what I mostly did. The scalloping is something that we're doing now because the fishing is at a low point.
Yeah.
There's a lot of cycles that occur. It's not always because of fishing being done over the limits. It's fish come and they go, and they're right now they're at a low level. Cod is at a low level. Haddock is at a high level. But scallops are worth the best money, and that's where we're going. But, yes, we use a net when we're not using the dredge. And the nets, it just goes above the bottom. It doesn't go right on the bottom. because it would tear up on the rocks. This is a net made of, you know, fibers.
Sure.
And we catch our fish with a net. But I've also fished with long lines. That's a long rope, and thousands of feet long, with a hook every 6 or 8 feet or so, with a baited hook on it.
Mm-hmm.
And we fish that way as well. So there's numerous ways, and we try to avoid doing things that are, you know, injurious to the environment, and that can happen with certain kinds of fish gear.
Well, what kind of surprises have you pulled up in the nets?
I think the biggest surprise we had was literally a whale. Now, whales live and whales die. They're not always, you know, killed by whalers. They had a life cycle, and when they die, most of them sink to the bottom. And we were fishing in an area of deep water for sole this particular trip, and we slowed way down. I hauled the net back up. It took quite a while to get it to the surface. There was obviously something heavy in it. I thought it might have been a beam or a piece of wreckage. And as we started reeling it in, it was at night. My son screamed from the stern of the boat. He said, "Stop, stop." And he ran in. He said, "Dad, there's a whale. His tail is sticking out of the mouth of the net." And I said, "Oh, my God, you've got to be kidding me." Well, we had scooped up a dead, decomposing whale. And that was, without a question of a doubt, the most surprising and most difficult thing that we ever dealt with. We ended up losing most of the net trying to free ourselves from this critter. But, it was the tail was as wide as the stern of the boat.
Oh, my.
It was really something. It was a big old whale that simply, I guess, just his time come, and down he went. They normally, you know, decompose over a period of months, and they'll break down. But this guy must have been a recent expiration.
Hmm. Bill Amaru is a commercial fisherman, a woodworker, a musician, and a Vermonter, and we're lucky to have him. Bill, thanks for being with us this morning.
You're too much of a flatterer. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
It's been ours. Let's pop out for a CBS News update. Then we're going to return for some more wacky, beautiful wonderfulness when we learn about a new exhibit in Brattleboro called Glass-tastic. And it is. This is Ron Viewpoint on WDEV.
Spring is springing. There's still plenty of snowpack, so good reason to visit the Mad River Valley. While you're here, make a stop at the almost world-famous Warren's Store. Newly renovated, delicious deli offerings and world-class bakery. Online ordering now available. You must be ready to ditch those COVID sweatpants. We've got some cute, comfy, casual clothing upstairs at the Warren Store from some of your favorite brands. Free People, Z-Supply, and Tribal, to name a few. Fall-winter clothing is still on sale, so head on down to Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. WarrenStore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Some quirky coincidence this is. Early this week, I was introduced to the music of a Scottish indie band called Glass Vegas. Then I got a press release from the Brattleboro Museum of Arts and Brattleboro Museum and Arts Center about an exhibit called Glass-tastic. The music is really cool. The exhibit, on the other hand, had me reaching out to the museum immediately to get someone to please be on the show so everyone can hear about this unique exhibit. And as if by some amazing twist of fate, Linda Wheelahan emerged to tell us the tales of Mr. Slime Blob, Swirly, Snake Guy, Rainbow Cat, and others. Linda is co-curator of the exhibit. Linda, it is so great to have you on the show today.
Well, thanks, Rick. I'm thrilled to be able to share Glass-tastic with everybody.
Yes, and listeners, if you've got a question or comment about Glass-tastic, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint at radiovermont.com. So please explain exactly what Glass-tastic is.
So I think Glass-tastic kind of gives you an idea of how exciting it is, but it's a show we've been doing every 2 years. This is our fifth iteration, and we ask kids in grades kindergarten through sixth grade to dream up creatures out of their imagination, and they submit those to us, and then we have just an amazing group of glass artists, 26 of them this year, who look at all of the, you know, they pour through all of the drawings, and we also ask the kids to write descriptions about the creatures as well. So the glass artists look at all of those. This year we had over 800 of them that were submitted, and then they choose the one that for some reason appeals to them and they really want to try and honor and recreate in glass. So it's We call it a celebration of imagination and ingenuity. So it's imagination on both the young artists and the young at heart artists, but the ingenuity that it takes for the glass artists to really bring these to sculptural form is just amazing.
Linda, can you possibly say or write Glasstastic without an exclamation point?
I don't think you can, no. It's a pretty joyful and exciting show, and everybody loves it. The glass artists, you know, they give us so much of their time. It's really a labor of love for them, and they're thrilled to be asked to be able to do it. So we're just honored that they feel that way, and the teachers who are involved, their kids and students are so enthusiastic about this. So it's just win-win. And then the visitors, when they come, you know, just wall-to-wall smiles in the gallery. So it's a super, super-duper thing, and I'm thrilled to be able to do it with my co-curator and colleague, Sarah Freeman, from the museum.
Yeah. Now, as you mentioned, it does have a long and illustrious history. How has it grown through the years?
So we started it, we kind of do it every 2 years. Mm-hmm. At one point, we had a three-year hiatus, but it started, our director saw a show, a similar show in Tacoma, Washington, and he thought it was a great thing to bring back to our museum. And we have so many, the area of Vermont, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, where our glass artists come from, we are just this rich with these really talented artists doing all sorts of different glasswork. So we thought it was a really great fit. And I think the first year they did it was in 2011, and they got maybe 200 submissions, and it was a longer period where families and kids could turn in the work. And last year, I think we hit a high, or last time we did it was 1,200 submissions. And this year, like I said, we got over 800. But considering how we had to change things up, I mean, with the pandemic, we used to do everything on, you know, on paper, and teachers would bring those into us, you know, piles of them in the fall. So over 800 is pretty good, considering things completely changed with the new situation. So.
Well, has the pandemic changed anything else the way Glasstastic is being done this year?
Yeah, actually, good things, the way the pandemic has changed. And I think for museums everywhere, is we've all have had to become more tech savvy. So this year, if you go to the website, for people that can't come to the exhibition, which I would hope that many people can come, but if you can't come, you can go to our website, and you'll see if you look up Glasstastic, there's a little button that says click here, and that will show you every submission that all the kids turned in. So I'll give you the picture of the drawing as well as the description. And then if you go to our Flickr gallery, which is on the upper right-hand corner, you can see the ones that were chosen, so the 27 sculptures that made it to the museum. And coming, I think, in a week and a half, we're going to have a virtual tour. So those are all, you know, we're a small museum with not a big budget or, you know, people with those skills, but we've managed to do it, and it's amazing. So technology, in some ways, not necessarily for me particularly, but is our friend. Really opened up the show.
There are positives that will come out of this pandemic, and that's one of them.
Yeah.
Linda, who are the young artists who create these creatures that will be turned into glass art?
Well, like I said, in most of the submissions we get through art teachers. So it's teachers delivering this lesson. And in the fall, again, the pandemic was a crazy time. We started, you could turn in submissions from September through December. So we launched this right at the beginning of school when things were crazy. And it was a nice thing, I think, for teachers to have something that they were familiar with and that the kids looked forward to, that they could sort of introduce the school year with such an exciting project. So a lot of them came from art classrooms. And then because, again, this was open to anybody, it wasn't open to only Vermont or New Hampshire or Massachusetts kids, things, you know, they could come from individual families who heard about the show. So, it's just all over the place, super duper.
And you mentioned, so there's a drawing, there's a description. They also name their creature, right?
Yes, they do. And I think probably listening to me blather on, I have some of the descriptions pulled up that I can read to you to give people an idea.
Oh, please
because
do.
Because this is a great show. You know, you're going to have to imagine what this looks like. So some of them are really fierce. So this one is Flame. by Banyan Altshuler, and I'm sorry, I don't have the grades for these kids. It's, again, in grades K through 6. So this one says, Flame is from the beginning of time and lives in the mountains. He has big orange wings so he can fly. Flame is also a very fierce climber, so he can climb the icy mountains in the winter when he isn't flying. His tail is for defense, and it stores poison in it. The spikes on the sides of his body shoot out when he is scared. Flame can be friendly at times when he's in the mood, but he can also be fierce. So that's one.
I love it.
And then coming from a different direction, we have Squiggly Be Biggly, which is done by Sarah Bailey-Wall. And just try, picture this, see if an image comes to your mind as I read this. Squiggly Be Biggly is a squiggle blob who lives in a cabbage with his wife, Andrea Bediggly, and children, Charlie, Phoebe, and Skye. His favorite food is pulled pork and nachos with whipped cream.
Oh,
he likes to play tennis with his wife and children or go bouncing on sandwich bread. Squiggly is his first name, and Bediggly his last. He has a blue eye and maroon slime, and then it just ends with the end because I couldn't think of anything to wrap it up, Sarah. So kids are really doing amazing things. It's such a struggle. I think that's one of the comments we get from the glass artists is how hard it is to choose the one that they want to do. And in one case, we had a glass artist who just couldn't make one choice, and he made two.
Oh,
so,
wow.
So
how are they? I mean, how do you go from, 1,200 a few years ago, this year 800, down to, a couple dozen that are actually chosen and then produced?
Well, that is not our choice. Again, like I said, the glass artists pour over these. They're given every single one digitally. Again, pandemic positive, so they could take their time. They had maybe a week to decide the one they wanted to do. So for whatever reason, some artists choose one that they think is a challenge for them. So they, these are very different from what most of the glass artists do in their studios. So I know for some particular artists, they choose one that's going to challenge them and give them a new skill set that they'll be able to use in their studio work.
Mm.
Others choose one just because of the description. So I don't know how much time we have, but I have examples of all of those.
We have all the time you need. You just go, Linda.
Okay, so this one was done by, and again, we've done this 5 years, and many of our glass artists are repeats. Have done it through all five shows. So, and we're excited to get, we've had the most glass artists this year than we've ever had. So we're really thrilled to be able to introduce their work too, because it just gives you such variety. So this one I know was chosen because it was a challenge. And this oftentimes, the glass artists generally try to be so true to the kids' drawing. So Lynn Latimer, who's a fused glass artist, which, we have different kinds of glass artists represented. Fused glass artists, artists who use flame work, which means you have a little torch on a bench and you're making very intricate patterns and shapes, working on a bench with a propane torch. And then glass blowers, which I think probably most people are more familiar with. So the one I'm going to read about, this is Windy by Sophia Kavanaugh. And again, if you have time, check these out on our website, because you'll be able to picture, you're going to get the actual picture of what the kid came up with and the resulting sculpture. But this is by Lynn Latimer. It says, my creature is a very sweet monster, and his name is Windy. He has 5 mouths, 3 tails, 6 hands, 10 eyes that go all over the place, and he wears 7 hats. He also has 2 layers of horns, which makes for a total of 15 horns altogether. Another cool thing about Windy is that he has flowers for hands. Windy is a magical monster, and he can splatter paint everywhere. And it looks colorful. He lives in a place called Splatville, where it's okay for him to splat paint anywhere he wants. So
I want to live
there. I think our teachers, when they heard that, are like, glad this kid might have made this at home and not at school. But yeah, so the picture is covered with little dots of paint, and Lynn was really able to capture that so perfectly using frit, so sandy pieces of glass to make the colors. Really, really great. I can't say enough about how wonderful our glass artists are.
Linda, why do art teachers and kids, museum visitors, the artists themselves look forward to this show?
Well, there's just so much joy in it. And in the past, when the pandemic wasn't such a big part of our world, kids and their teachers could take field trips to the Brattleboro Museum, and that's still a possibility. But again, the online option would allow the teachers to show all these images in their classroom. But I would encourage, the exhibit is going to be up until June 13th, and you could, if you came to Brattleboro, you could really fill the day up coming to the exhibit, and then you could visit some of the glass studios. A few of the glass artists have open studio times where you can either drop in or make appointments. And at the other end of town, one of our teachers at the local school closest to us brought their kids to the retreat farm to look at the real animals and look at their attributes. And then before they did their drawings, they were thinking about what the animals at the retreat farm, which is a working farm, or not a working farm, but a fun children's farm, had, and how they could incorporate those, or what their creature might, what special attributes their creature might have. So in the spring, maybe things are going to open up. I hope everybody can come and make a day of it in Brattleboro. When we were talking earlier about setting this interview up, I said that you are my very favorite radio interviewer, since this is my very first radio interview. But one of the creatures actually is also an interviewer. So this one is British Ketchup Man by Delaney Steedley. And it says, my ketchup bottle is usually just plain and red. So I thought that I would make a British ketchup bottle. The British part of it stands for James Corden, because he's just funny and cool, and the ketchup is just ketchup doing something ketchup can't do in real life. So I took British and ketchup together to make, boom, British Ketchup Man. So British Ketchup Man is a Heinz 57 bottle. It's got a top hat and a lot of personality. So there are creatures of all kinds, and if you... Some years there seems to be a theme that goes through many of the kids' drawings. So a few years ago it was tacos. So if you go to our website, Chelsea Osborne, who's another fantastic staff member at the museum, spent hours on our website. You can search for a particular thing. So if you're into tacos, you can type in tacos. And I did that this morning, and five different things came up featuring tacos. So
I love it.
Just something for everybody.
Well, Linda, I am glad that I still rank ahead of British Ketchup Man in your book. That makes me feel
good. You are number one, Rick. Number one.
And you're number one with me, Linda. Hey, the artists, where do they come from?
So again, like I said, we're just so lucky to have so many artists close by. So Vermont, New Hampshire, and Massachusetts. And I've been very fortunate to be able to visit a lot of the studios. And we have... just a variety of work people are doing. So some glass artists in their real life make are studio artists, and they make production things to sell. Some people make fantastic pieces of sculpture and art. It's just really amazing what people do. So one of the artists who is new this year is Chris Hubbard, and he shares a studio with two of the other flame workers who are in the show. And flame workers, if people aren't familiar with that, usually make smaller things, not just because of the way they're working. Mm-hmm. And we usually ask artists to make a sculpture that's at least 8 inches wide, just because we're going to be displaying it in the, you know, as an exhibit. And this artist, Chris Hubbard, his creature he chose was Daisy by Toriel Lee. So this description is, her name is Daisy. She lives in a rainbow city in the sky. She likes playing with her rainbow friends and napping in the clouds. It looks like a rainbow with eyes, a mouth, hands, legs, and feet. She's unique because she is a rainbow and she is alive. Hmm. So in the drawing, it just features one rainbow with a lot of personality. But Chris just went to town and made about 7 different smaller sculptures surrounding the bigger rainbow. So he's got little clouds, little baby rainbow friends. they really like them. Go all out. It's really super.
What is it like when the kid artists get to see what the grown-up artists have created from their original drawing and description?
Oh, that is wonderful, and I wish I could share a moment from the last time we did this. So in the past, we've had an opening, and last year we made little buttons with the finished sculpture. So the kid artists and the grown-up artists were wearing these buttons, and they kind of had to find each other during the opening.
Oh.
And we have the cutest picture of, I don't know, he's probably in second grade, and he's the little kid artist is dressed up in a suit, you know, looks very sharp, and the glass artist looks more thrilled to be meeting him than he does. it's a really wonderful, wonderful thing.
What happens with the artwork after the exhibit?
So we, each time we do it, we've had a different plan for that. We love it when the glass pieces can go home with the kid artists. And this year, Friends of the Museum are sponsoring. And if you want to be a friend of the museum, you can just contact the museum and make arrangements. But the Friends of the Museum are very generously paying the fee that tries to cover some of the cost of the show. So all the sculptures will be going home with their very nervous parents. take them home safely. Again, pandemic, we have one sculpture that's going all the way back to Washington State. So, And glass artists, I must say, are awfully good at packing their creations, too, because they've had to send them all over the place. But the family that found out about the show in Washington State actually found out about it from friends in Brooklyn, and I have a pretty good one to read. Do we have time for this?
We do, yeah.
So this is Brooklyn Spaghetti and Meatball Monster by Tandy June Johnson. And the Brooklyn Spaghetti and Meatball Monster lives on a plate near Flatbush Avenue in New York City. His eyes are meatballs, and he has long eyelashes that wave at people. But you can't tell his eyelashes from the rest of them. Only his mom can tell the difference. He's giving a thumbs up and a thumbs down to COVID-19 because social distancing means that people will keep their distance, and he's safe from being eaten. But he misses getting close with his friend Cheese. So, pretty sweet.
They are so clever, Linda.
Yeah. Yeah, you can see why it's such a struggle for the glass artists to choose just one.
Yeah. You said this goes through June 13th. What are the hours at the museum?
So the museum is open, I wrote this down, so I wouldn't forget, Wednesday through Sunday. So we're closed Mondays and Tuesdays, and the hours are 10 to 4. And this is one of probably five other exhibits that are just wonderful that just opened. So it's come for everybody, and yeah. You got to do it. Come on.
And you can check this out. You can check this one out and the other exhibits. The website address is brattleboromuseum.org. And as Linda said, you can also become a friend of the museum at brattleboromuseum.org. Linda Wheelahan is the co-curator of Glasstastic at the Brattleboro Museum and Arts Center. Like I said, BrattleboroMuseum.org. Linda, you're number one in my books. Thanks for sharing the brilliance of the children and the artists who have created this exhibit.
Oh, thanks so much. And I just last closing, we can all use some creature comforts, and these are the creatures, so come check out the show.
It's really they are unbelievable. So people, please go. BrattleboroMuseum.org. Thanks again, Linda.
Thanks so much, Rick. Bye.
Take care. We're going to break now for CBS News. We'll be back to talk to national correspondent Bob Ney. Then we'll talk to Allison Novak from 7 Days. And at 10:30, we open up the phones and you take over again. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Spring is springing. There's still plenty of snowpack, so good reason to visit the Mad River Valley. While you're here, make a stop at the almost world-famous Warren's Store. Newly renovated, delicious deli offerings and world-class bakery. Online ordering now available. You must be ready to ditch those COVID sweatpants. We've got some cute, comfy, casual clothing upstairs at the Warren Store from some of your favorite brands. Free People, Z Supply, and Tribal, to name a few. Fall winter clothing is still on sale, so head on down to Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. WarrenStore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. It's time to turn to national correspondent Bob Ney to get an idea of what happened this week. Bob, thanks for coming back. Great to have you.
Well, thank you, Rick.
All right, Bob, let's start with the numbers, the COVID count.
Yes, pleasure to say that, it's obviously still getting better. I mean, there are people that have passed, but the numbers are not like they used to be when we would see them go up so, dramatically. Total deaths worldwide are 2,674,000. The total deaths in the United States are 537,000, which again, of course, has toppled the 500,000 mark, but we were seeing numbers going up, so extreme at one point in time. So I think the vaccinations and the fact, of people doing what they needed to do to separate and masks and different things are obviously beginning to kick in.
Speaking of vaccinations, the U.S. Will be sending some vaccines to Mexico and Canada.
Right. We're going to help them, and it's with the it's called AstraZeneca vaccine, basically, it's a vaccine that we haven't approved at this point in time, but we have it in storage. I was surprised to find out that we have, I think, 30-some million in the state of Ohio, where I'm from, doses that are just sitting in a facility. So this is the first time that we'll be actually, you know, putting them out to another country, and we're doing it again with Canada and Mexico because they're short on their vaccinations. You know, and there's an article in here, and I, you know, I was so surprised, Rick, about the amount that we, you know, have produced. We produced 27% of the vaccines manufactured anywhere in the world. We're second only to China. China is exporting 60% of its vaccines that is produced. And it's in part due to a low sense of urgency in China, where the virus is largely under control. So in my mind, some things aren't adding up. You know, why does China export 60%? They're not vaccinating, obviously. They're not having to push to vaccinate the majority of their people. They don't have a sense of urgency. Yet, you know, here we have a huge debate in the United States. If you've had the double vaccine or the one Pfizer shot, how long should you still wear a mask? Should you wear two masks? You know, obviously, Senator Rand Paul and Dr. Fauci got into that yesterday. But I read this about China, and it just makes me wonder where their thinking is. You know, we're pushing to try to get 80% of our population, and China, meanwhile, is exporting 60% of its product.
Wow. And that AstraZeneca vaccine, we should note, for a little bit during the week, there was a scare about whether it was causing blood clots, but it looks like that has been cleared of that connection.
Yes, there was a scare, and they had raised the issue in Europe with it, and then they found out that it in general doesn't do it. I'm not saying that something couldn't have an effect.
Right.
You know, anything could, but in general, it's not happening.
On a very negative note, we've been seeing this rise in attacks on Asian Americans.
Yes, it's something that actually I did a little bit of surfing on the internet, and I came up with quite a few stories of attacks, not just in the last month or so, but over a period of time in San Francisco, where there's a large Asian American population, and there were attacks out there, and it wasn't just confined to Caucasians. There were attacks also on Asians by blacks and some other people that really weren't identified too had been attacking some Asians out there. So I saw that, and I wondered how far back, you know, some of this has went. Now, there's a big debate in Congress that occurred yesterday during one of the hearings where, you know, some of the people were saying, well, you shouldn't really say too much about the country of China because that could be taken wrong. But I think we've got to be real careful on that, too, because, of course, there was a furious battle of words back and forth about people saying, look, I'm going to go after China. It doesn't mean I'm going after, you know, Chinese people, but I'm going to go after the country of China because of what they're doing to the United States and, you know, trade and other property rights issues and things like that. So that's going to obviously, you know, flare up. I think it'll be important what the president says. He and the vice president are on their way to Atlanta.
Right.
And so we'll see what they can say that maybe will help to heal. I mean, you can't stop, in some cases, people like this horribly unbalanced guy down there that did this. I mean, you try to, you know, who knew that he was going to do it? If they would have known, I'm sure they could have, you know, tried to have gotten to him. So we'll have to see what his motive is and where this all lands. But I knew that whole issue about China as a government was going to come into play yesterday, and it did in the House side.
Well, speaking of U.S. and China relations, let's talk about foreign policy. And the U.S., a couple of our envoys meeting with the Chinese in Alaska, and didn't get off to the greatest of starts, did it, Bob?
Well, yes. You know, we're sitting here talking about the members of the House arguing, you know, with each other about right. what you can or can't say about using the word, you know, China. And it got off to a not so friendly start. I would love to have been there to see what they said when the doors closed,
right.
but it the Chinese were assuming that President Biden would restart the clock on all of this, and he's not. He's taking a tough line against China. He talked about, you know, he talked about human rights, et cetera. And then China came back and, of course, talked about every ill that we have here, you know, our government, what we do to people around the world, what we do to countries, our aggressiveness. So, yes, it was everything but the fist flying yesterday in the opening volleys up in Alaska.
Well, another swing that the Biden administration, Joe Biden himself, took was at Vladimir Putin.
Yes, this one was, you know, this one was big. He basically said, you know, he was involved with murder, and Putin came back and, you know, of course, slapped back at the at our president, just saying, well, also, you know, the ills of the United States and our problems that we have, whether it's racial or the, you know, insurrection at the Capitol. And so they went at each other. Now, what's interesting about it, though, is that, you know, President Biden, as Senator Biden, has known Putin for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. And I think in one hand, the president's trying to not, you know, cozy up or say complimentary things about Putin to put kind of lay this on a table where he's going to be. But yet both of them did the big time diplomatic thing. It was, well, yeah, we'll talk to each other by telephone. Both of them indicated that. So we'll see where it goes. So we've been in a cold war with Russia for the last 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, we really have. Bob, this is interesting that the House has passed a bipartisan bill that would grant legal status to undocumented farm workers. So give us some details on that.
Yes, it's one of two bills dealing with immigration issues. And the first bill was with the farm workers, and it would give them, since they're undocumented working on the farms as migrant farm workers, it would give them a path to citizenship. This was most likely supported by the farm groups, especially along the border areas, and it did have some Republicans that supported it. So I know it's an issue that they've had out there for a long time. And the second deals with the Dreamers. You know, it was called DACA before. Deals with the Dreamers. And it's kind of interesting. It's almost as if the House is picking off the easier ones, obviously, to start. I don't know if that's a good strategy. I kind of was hoping they would put the whole ball of wax together, where you had the Dreamers and the farmers and the border security, you know, all mixed together, maybe to get a comprehensive bill. But right now they've picked out the Dreamers and also the farm workers. And the Dreamers, of course, are people that were brought here mainly as children. They were born here. I'm just take a second if I could take the liberty.
Sure.
I know of a personal case that it's tragic. At Ohio State University, there was this girl had gotten her undergraduate degree, born and raised in Columbus, Ohio, went to get her master's, and they called her in and they said, "You are illegally here," when she gave them her Social Security number. And she was 22, and it ended up she was deported. And this was back, by the way, this was during the Obama administration time. She was deported, sent to Mexico. She had never been there, could not speak one sentence of Spanish. Her father had never told her that he brought her here illegally as a baby. She had a fiancé. He had a nervous breakdown. He was born and raised in Columbus. It's just a very, very tragic case. But that's a typical Dreamer, you know, yeah. Raised here. Some of them, and he didn't even know that they were brought here or born here.
Wow. National correspondent Bob Ney, as always, want to thank you for bringing us up to date on what happened this week.
Thank you so much, Rick.
Okay. Always love being informed. We're going to take a break, and then Allison Novak of 7 Days joins us. We're going to talk about remembrances of Burlington High School from when it was last downtown. This is Ron Viewpoint on WDEV.
When you run a small business out of your home, reliable power is important. Just ask Tricia Fong. She and her husband bought their Kohler generator from Brookfield Service.
My husband and I, we run small businesses out of our house, and it's very important for us to have a computer and internet access. When the power goes out in our area, which does rather frequently because we live in the mountains, with our generator, we are constantly with power. A business where you do need the computer and internet service, with the generator, we are always in business. The business has been fantastic. They've been very reliable, and within a moment's notice, they're always here.
Hi, this is Brenna from Brookfield Service. Let us design a Kohler standby power system for your home or business. You'll be pleased to know Kohler standby power is quite affordable. Next time, be prepared. Call us at 1-866-POWER-97 for over a quarter of a century providing shelter from the storm with Kohler generators. BrookfieldService.com.
Hi, I'm Joseph Payak. I'm Chief Science Officer for Vermont Organic Science.
And I'm Paige Payak.
We're in the hemp extraction business. We extract CBD, CBG, all the different cannabinoids. So we provide a service for the farmers, turning their crops into something that they can sell. Banking in this sector was very difficult to find. Vermont is just very supportive of our industry. VSECU came through for us. We would recommend the credit union.
I feel the same way. You know, it's a challenge to start your own business. I would recommend VSECU to anyone, whether you're a business or an individual.
Greg and the team really did their job.
The support you get, they're the best, and I wouldn't go anywhere else.
Dealing with VSECU has been such a breath of fresh air.
Wonderful organization.
VSECU honestly cares about their customers.
Make change simply by banking at VSECU.com.
This credit union is federally insured by the NCUA.
Spring is springing. There's still plenty of snowpack, so good reason to visit the Mad River Valley. While you're here, make a stop at the almost world-famous Warren's Store. Newly renovated, delicious deli offerings, and world-class bakery. Online ordering now available. You must be ready to ditch those COVID sweatpants. We've got some cute, comfy, casual clothing upstairs at the Warren Store from some of your favorite brands. Free People, Z Supply, and Tribal, to name a few. Fall winter clothing is still on sale, so head on down to Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. WarrenStore.com.
Sundays on WDEV, a day like no other, with local news, sports, Sunday Swing Time with host Joel Nashman, and CBS Sunday Morning. Brought to you in part by Good News Garage, Vermont's original and local car donation program, accepting donated vehicles as tax-deductible donations and providing them to our neighbors in need. To donate a car and change a life, visit goodnewsgarage.org or call 877-GIVE-AUTO.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. Burlington High School students have been through a lot this school year. Now they're attending classes downtown in the old Macy's department store. It's a bit interesting and different and something they'll be sharing with their children and grandchildren through the years. But what about the last time BHS was actually downtown? Here to discuss the stories that she's heard from that era is Allison Novak, who reports on education for 7 days. Allison, thanks for being on with us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Where and when was there a public high school in downtown Burlington?
So pre-1965, the Edmonds High School, which is now Edmonds Middle School, right on Main Street, was there until the Institute Road New North End campus was built, and the class of 65 was the first to attend in the north end of Burlington. But until 64, there was a high school in downtown Burlington, which is now middle school.
And so when they moved, what condition was Edmonds in when it was, you know, when they moved out to North Street?
So, I mean, it had basically become pretty overcrowded. And so one alum remembers that, you know, the wooden staircase at the center of the building had this, like, big dip in the middle from years of feet stomping up and down. It was built and opened in 1900. So it had been 64 years of, increased enrollment every year. And so it was, you know, it's an old, stately building, but it was definitely it had kind of outlasted its use for as a high school.
And I said North Street. That's where I go to the shopping bag. I meant North Ave.
Yeah.
Yeah. The two actually do meet, which is kind of kooky, too. And was it a lot of excitement, you know, that the students and the faculty had when they were moving out to that new facility?
Yeah, I talked to a 1964 grad who, you know, was his first, he was the last class that was in the downtown building, and he said, you know, he remembers when the new campus opened, you know, everyone was oohing and aahing, it was state of the art, people were really excited about this kind of fancy new building out on North Avenue.
Unfortunately, years later, we learned they used PCPs and had to move everybody out of that. How fondly did alumni hold that old building, the Edmonds building, when you spoke with them?
You know, I think that the alumni I spoke with, about half a dozen alumni who graduated between the 1940s and early 60s. And, you know, they really loved being downtown. I think just the having jobs after school downtown. One grad from 1960 talked about how they would hurry down to the Hitching Post restaurant at the corner of Church and Main Street for lunch and get grilled cheese or tuna salad, and all the waitresses kind of knew their order by heart because they were regulars. And so I think, you know, the alumni I talked to really enjoyed being downtown in downtown Burlington.
Now, the Hitching Post, is that what is now, it's right there.
Honey Road.
Honey Road, yeah. Is that what that was?
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
How about that? Yeah, and yeah, tell us more about how the students would avail themselves to downtown Burlington at the time.
So one of the most interesting conversations I had was with a 91-year-old woman named Flora Palm, who graduated in 1948. She talked about how, you know, students were really tracked at that time. So there was the basic track, the commercial track, and the college-bound track. She was on the commercial track, and so, you know, her guidance counselor at the school helped her find a job at Woolworth's her junior year of high school, where she worked in the hardware department for 35 cents an hour. And then later, her senior year, you know, she told her guidance counselor that she wanted to be a CPA, but he basically told her, you know what, that's not a woman's job, but I'll help you find another job. And so, you know, hearing that was just, obviously we all know that that kind of thing happened, but just hearing firsthand, I think, really struck me. But, you know, he did help her find a job as a secretary at UVM the spring of her senior year. And she said she kind of started on a temporary basis in the spring of her senior year. Someone was pregnant and left for a couple weeks. And she said she ended up staying in that job for 10 years. So, yeah, I think several of the people I talked to had jobs downtown. Joyce Alberelli, a 1949 grad, worked at the Concord Candy Kitchen, which was another restaurant long gone on the corner of Church and Bank Streets. And she said every day after school she would work there until about 7 or 8 p.m. and on weekends as well.
Wow. Now, the building itself lacked certain facilities. So where did they host athletic events and artistic performances?
Yeah, so I think there is definitely the parks around Burlington were used for sports games. So Callahan Park, which was called South Park at the time, as well as Roosevelt and Smalley Parks were used for football and baseball. And then Memorial Auditorium is where basketball games were held. So one of the women I talked to was a cheerleader and remembers, you know, evening basketball games at Memorial Auditorium. And that's also where some of the theater productions were held in the early 60s.
That would be pretty exciting to be a high school student performing there in the Odd, which would have been a really big, at that time, big facility for them.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, just everyone I talked to really remembered downtown Burlington as, you know, a wonderful place to go to school, and Burlington is a wonderful place to grow up.
Well, and Church Street was open at the time, so I think you heard stories about the high school kids cruising right down Church Street.
Yep. A 1960 grad told me that, you know, that was a big weekend activity, cruising up and down Church Street. She also remembered, you know, there was a sporting goods store named Wood Sporting Goods that was on Church and Bank Street, and she said she remembered, you know, cars pulling up with their deer or occasionally a bear strapped to them because it was a big game weigh station at the time. And so I just was thinking, you know, thinking about Church Street now, it's kind of amazing to think about that happening.
I think Vermonters would handle it somewhat if they saw somebody with a deer strapped to the car pulling up there now. But I think our visitors from away might have a little bit of a shock.
Yeah.
It is a beautiful story of high school memories, even if you aren't from Burlington, and even if you didn't know the school, you've really provided this great snapshot of a previous era. So how do you go about doing that?
You know, so one of my main sources for people who had graduated from the 40s to 60s was a Facebook page called Burlington Area History, which is run by a man named Bob Bulliard, who didn't go to Burlington High School, but he grew up in the area. And so I posted on that page to kind of see if people would be willing to share recollections. And a bunch of people, you know, said they would. Some people said, you know, my mother, who's 91, this is the woman Laura Palm I ended up talking to, her daughter had said, you know, I'm sure my mother would love to talk to you about her experience. And I got in touch with her. So, that was, and you know, then just through other people, my in-laws, actually, my mother-in-law grew up in Burlington, in the 60s. So I was able to connect with some people that way as well. It was wonderful talking to people who really had, you know, who are older and, but just had really clear, crisp memories of going to school downtown. And who, you know, probably hadn't been asked about them in a while. And, you know, one woman started talking and she said, you know, the more I talk, the more things come flooding back. And so I really, you know, every article I write, I learn something, but I feel like this one, I really learned a lot.
There's great photos along with the story as well. And so did Flora ever become a CPA?
She didn't. No, she did end up getting her degree an education degree and worked at her children's school. They went to Barnes, which was on North Street, and she was a paraprofessional there. And then she actually joined the school board in Burlington along with her husband in the 80s. So she became involved in education.
Oh, good. Fantastic. Now, there were actually two downtown high schools for a while. What do you know about Cathedral High School?
So, yeah, Cathedral High School was the Catholic school that, you know, has since become Rice Memorial High School in South Burlington. That school was around until 1959 as well. So I spoke with a grad of Cathedral High School, Pat Robbins, who told me that, you know, they were basically number one rivals, Edmonds and Cathedral. There wasn't a ton of interaction between students outside of sports, and those who had kind of personal connections outside of school. But there's two high schools in downtown Burlington at that time. So
one of the other things you write about in the story was how convenient it was just kind of walking and getting to the high school for students.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so a lot of them talked about, you know, fondly about walking to school and picking up friends along the way. And so, you know, they would be kind of a posse of 10 to 12 students by the time they arrived and just it being kind of a social time. And then another grad talked about, you know, being able to just walk up to work at UVM. He worked for a professor at UVM right after school. So, but yeah, I think quite a few people walked to school. And then there, I think in the 60s, early 60s, people could drive to school, but one grad told me, you know, there was no designated parking spots for students. And so you had to kind of get there early and cruise around in order to find a spot.
Oh, wow. And, now the new downtown Burlington High School, tell us a little bit about that and how long students will be there.
So at least 3.5 years. So they just moved in a couple of weeks ago, and the lease that the school district signed is for 3.5 years. You know, they're still trying to figure out what's going to happen with the North Avenue campus. Like you had mentioned, there's contamination from PCBs, which are kind of chemicals that were used in the caulking of windows, as well as the adhesives to put the flooring on. And so they have to do more testing, and they don't think that that's going to be done until later in the summer. So for the time being, they are going to be downtown, and I think it really remains to be seen what's going to happen with the North Avenue campus, whether they're going to be able to, you know, remediate the PCBs, or they're going to have to possibly, you know, tear it down and build something new. So.
And we only have about a minute left, but what has been the reaction of students and residents and downtown business people to having the school downtown again?
So Church Street Marketplace is pretty excited. They delivered these packets of coupons from local businesses to students and teachers about a week or two ago. And, you know, PokeWorks gave Hawaiian fruit drinks to all the teachers. That's a PokeBowl place on Church Street. There's been some businesses that have been doing kind of giveaways, like a silver seahorse necklace in honor of the school's mascot was given away by Tradewinds. And then I talked to a woman who was organizing kind of a big cookie making drive for the students at the end of March. She's from Cathedral Church of St. Paul, which is kind of right next to the school, the Macy School, and she plans to bake. Oh, not just her, but her and her fellow parishioners plan to bake 70 dozen cookies and hand them out to students at the end of March. So I think people are, you know, the welcome wagon is coming out. So.
Perfect. Allison Novak reports on education for 7 days, and you can read her story in this week's 7 days or at 7daysvt.com. Thanks so much, Allison.
Thank you very much.
All right. We're going to take a break. We'll be back with open phones until 11 o'clock here on Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Spring is springing. There's still plenty of snowpack, so good reason to visit the Mad River Valley. While you're here, make a stop at the almost world-famous Warren's Store. Newly renovated, delicious deli offerings and world-class bakery. Online ordering now available. You must be ready to ditch those COVID sweatpants. We've got some cute, comfy, casual clothing upstairs at the Warren Store from some of your favorite brands. Free People, Z Supply, and Tribal, to name a few. Fall winter clothing is still on sale, so head on down to Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. WarrenStore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. All right, let's open up those phones until 11 o'clock. I had full shows Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. But I'm ending the week with a chance for you to hop on. Let me know what you're thinking. Just heard from Allison Novak from 7 Days. She was talking about Burlington High School alums sharing their memories of the old downtown high school. If there are some great high school memories from a Vermont school you want to share, you can call us. Maybe it's an old school building that you attended that you loved a lot. My first apartment in Vermont was in the old North Barry School, and I had the 8th grade classroom was my apartment, a great apartment, especially to have friends over. I had like 15 high-foot ceilings, something ridiculous. It was fabulous. Another favorite of mine, I love the building, the Hyde Park Elementary. I've never been in it, but from outside looks like it'd be a neat one. We could talk seafood. We had Bill Amaru on earlier. We can talk art, women's history, whatever you'd like, or I might break out the poetry again. And we are at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And, again, open it up to whatever topic you like. It might be something we've addressed today or this week. Feel free. We've got the governor's COVID-19 response news conference coming up. If you want to talk about maybe you've been vaccinated, what that was like going through the process of registering and getting the vaccine, we'd love to hear. Maybe you'll help allay the fears of someone who's afraid to get it, or maybe you'll tell us it was not a great experience. Just want to hear what you went through. 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. 8255. Those are the numbers to call today. We've got the phones open till 11 o'clock. Boy, we had Wade in Moortown. He left us. I was hoping he'd hang on and we could open up with Wade, but we'll see who we get. Again, 244-1777, 877-291-TALK is the toll-free number from outside the Waterbury area. Yeah, reaching for my poetry book. If I have to read, I will read Herb Elliott's. It's from Let's Take Your Last Look. I did some reading last week. I lost my sheet of poems that I really enjoyed. But we'll stumble our way through this hour if you don't call 277-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can tell me how to calm the cows. You can even throw on a listing for the Trading Post. We've got time right now to have some fun here on the open phones of Vermont Viewpoint. All right. Let's see. It was really interesting hearing Bill Amaru talk about his love of the sea. You know, he was a symphonic clarinet player, and but was drawn back to the sea. I've heard it from people like Chester Abbott, who I've had on this show. Chester was grew up on a dairy farm and couldn't wait to get away and get off the farm and not be a dairy farmer, and eventually came back to it. He has an organic dairy farm up there in Randolph, up there on the ridge, and he loves it. You know, sometimes what you grow up with, you wind up going back to. Now, my dad was a steel worker, and on the weekends and in evenings, he would install oil burners and plumbing, and I would have to help him with that. And amazingly, I was not drawn to steel making or becoming a plumber. I just wasn't very good with my hands. He'd have me clean the copper ends, the fittings. That was probably the best thing I was decent at. All right, we do have Wade back from Moortown. Hey, Wade, go right ahead.
How you doing, Rick?
Good. How you been?
Pretty good. I was reminiscing the old days in Burlington.
Yeah. Is that where you grew up?
Actually, I grew up in South Burlington.
Okay.
And but my the other part of my family went to Burlington, and I went to South Burlington, graduated in 66, so we all hung around in Burlington.
Mm-hmm.
So the big thing was Coleman's.
Oh.
Coleman's drugstore, and you had your, you know, like in the movie Fonzie there, was it Happy Days?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Where they had the tables and all that, and you get sandwiches, same idea as that.
Wow.
You had kids waiting outside to get in because it was so small. Then the thing was cruising up Church Street. The
yep.
whole thing was to hear the exhaust bouncing off the buildings.
Oh,
so it was really, really loud.
Yep.
So if you were going to do your last run, you dropped it down to the low and just let it scream and get out of Dodge for the cops to come after you.
So that was you, Wade. You were that guy.
Oh, yeah, that was me, yeah. My brother-in-law and brothers. And we'd land up. You go up Church Street, then you go around Battery Park.
Mm-hmm.
Back then you could drive. You go around Battery Park cruising.
Okay.
And you went down Battery Street.
Yeah.
And Battery Street was actually the where you drag if you wanted to drag with somebody.
Oh, wow, down the hill.
So that was the run.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
What a blast.
Well, I'm hoping that the statute of limitations has run out on you and your brothers, so I think you're all right to head back into Burlington these days.
I'm still careful.
Yeah. Now, where was South Burlington High School at the time? Is it the same place it is now, or
place? Yeah, they just had built that.
Oh, wow.
Oh, I want to say back in 72. No, it had to be. I graduated in 66.
Yeah.
So it was in the 50s. They built it.
Oh, okay.
I know it was like a couple of years old when I went there.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And then Edmonds High School, you remember that before they moved out to the new high school in Burlington?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah. Because I had a brother, my oldest sister, my two oldest sisters and my brother went there.
Okay.
That was before they built South Burlington.
Oh, interesting. All right.
Yeah.
And then at Coleman's, what would you order?
The favorite was the French fries with gravy. Everybody wanted the French fries. You get the beef gravy or the turkey gravy.
Oh, man.
And to get a burger on the side or whatever you wanted.
Yeah.
But like I said, there was also a waiting line to get in there.
That's fantastic.
Oh, God, I'll never forget those days.
Wow, what great memories, Wade. Well, thanks for sharing them. And,
okay.
Yeah, it takes us all back. Yeah, that's Wade from Moortown. Great stories today from Allison Novak from 7 Days, writing about how the new high school downtown has brought back memories of the old high school, what's now Edmonds Middle School, was Edmonds High School, right there on Main Street. So you pass it as you head into downtown, coming, you know, from UVM or coming off the interstate. It's there on the left. And back in the day, that was the high school. But sagging steps and other, you know, no facilities for athletics or for putting on a performance were at the high school itself. So eventually moved out to down North Ave. And, of course, now with the PCB problem, they're in a Macy's. So how surreal would it be? And there are still, what's really interesting is there are still ads up in the Macy's for, like, Levi jeans. There are still racks. It's almost like you are still in Macy's. You just can't go shopping. But there's escalators, Lee. There's escalators in the high school, you know, that are going all the time. So you're in the Macy's. But they've just kind of cordoned it off and done probably a very good job to make it comfortable.
So are there classrooms upstairs?
I don't think so. I don't know how much is upstairs. Well, so Macy's was two stories.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I'm sure there are.
Well, they must be two stories. Why else would you have an escalator?
Well, yeah, so there was out in the mall, you know, there were two stories. But I don't know how much of the old mall is left. Macy's was kind of a separate building unto itself that you could access downstairs, and then once in Macy's, there were escalators, so it was a two-story building. Big, beautiful entryway, too, when you'd get to see it. You didn't really see it much because that old mall blocked it, you know, but if you walked down the sidewalk where the Macy's entrance was, you would see this big, beautiful, this artwork almost, almost like a mosaic where you walk into. And really quite interesting.
I have to plead guilty. I was doing something that took my attention away, filling out my bracket. I'm sorry.
Oh. All right.
But what of the cafeteria? How are the students feeding themselves during the school day, or are they?
Well, that's a great question. Maybe someone can answer that. I don't know if they have a cafeteria. I think I'm sure
they're heading down to the food court.
I'm sure they're, well, that's well gone.
Oh, that's true.
But I'm sure they're heading into town every chance they get. I know I would. You can help Lee Cattell with his NCAA bracket, maybe give him some tips, and pick Texas Southern to go all the way or something wonderful like that. It's always those weird upsets that you need to get right, you know, to win a bracket, right, Lee?
Well, I have a fresh theme for this year's bracket. All of my final four teams are from the Big Ten Conference.
Really?
Yeah.
Ohio State, Michigan,
Iowa, and Illinois.
Well, not bad.
They're all very good teams this year, and the Big Ten was a difficult conference to go with. I think a lot of people are picking Gonzaga because they're undefeated, but I'm not falling for that trap.
Right. Yep, that usually is a fool's errand there, but Iowa has the kid who can hit from
right
anywhere. And
Luka Garza, last year's a player of the year, and probably an All-American again this year, yeah, so... Oh, right. We'll see if he can Larry Bird the team's way into the national championship, yeah, like Bird did with Indiana State back in
that was very
back
exciting
in the day.
Indiana State, Michigan State, what a border rival that was! And everyone thought of it, the two states there right next to each other, one on top of each other, back in the day. Magic against Larry Bird, that was incredible stuff.
But despite my method, the poll, as always, seems to go to somebody who knows very little, if anything, about college basketball, which is me this year, because I didn't watch a single game.
Yeah, someone picking it by mascots. They've got the Drexel Dragons going everywhere. You know. Our numbers are 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Wouldn't mind seeing Drexel go all the way. When I was a kid, we used to watch Big Five basketball out of Philly, and the Big Five is Penn, St. Joe's, LaSalle, Villanova, and Temple, but they all play at the Palestra, and you would get to see Drexel play back then, Philadelphia Textiles, Philadelphia Pharmacy. Those have changed names, I believe. But you get to see those schools. Ryder would come in, maybe. I don't know if Swarthmore would get in there, but you get to see all these schools from the area playing as well. And it was great basketball to grow up with. And when I was a kid playing basketball in grade school, our coach used to have us watch it to learn, you know, how to play better, how to, you know, play better defense, et cetera. But it was a great excuse when, you know, the rest of your family wanted to watch Happy Days, and you'd have to say, no, man, I've got to watch Big Five basketball.
Yeah, you think the Fonzie's cool. Wait till you get a load of this tournament.
That's right. All right, we're at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. That's 877-291-TALK. Wide open for you, whatever you want to talk about. There's a lot of things that you can... Oh, we did have a... you checked it out, Lee, and... there is indeed a cafeteria at the new Burlington High School in the Macy's. So,
yeah, I don't have many details about it, but they did include among all of the things that they put together, a library and a cafeteria is part of the new downtown Burlington High School.
Nice. And I know they did a lot of work in a short amount of time. I think Dave Farrington, whose company, Farrington Construction, did a lot of work. And Dave is one of the three partners on what would be the new City Place. So I think he did a lot of work on getting the Macy's ready to go. All right, I'm going to have to read.
That's probably a good thing. Everybody would head right across the street to the Ben & Jerry's Scoop Shop for lunch.
Yeah. Well, that would be for dessert, I'm hoping. I hope the kids still want something nutritious first before they hit the Ben & Jerry's.
There's no vitamins in that waffle cone?
Well, there is, but I'm going to say it's probably negative calories. Hey, I'm not trying to slam Ben & Jerry's.
That's good ice cream.
Yeah, I would do that for lunch. All right, I'm going to read a poem from Herb Elliott. The book is called Take Your Last Look. Herb was a farmer and a poet in St. Johnsbury, and his daughter found his poems after he passed away and had this nice little publication printed up. And here, this one's called Autumn Nightfall. The last brown birds have turned their beaks to south and fled beyond the peaks. There is no cry of robin now. The wind plucks fire from the bough and whistles with a wintry sound and shakes wild apples to the ground. Tonight the maple leaves will shed and carpet mountain roads with red. It's the other end of the season's Autumn Nightfall, but I read that now because yesterday I was home and I heard the honking of my first Canada geese of the season flying over, and that's always exciting to know that they are returning, that all of a sudden the birds are doing just the opposite of what I read in that poem. They have now turned north and are returning to us, so we'll see more and more of that in the days ahead. Of course, I posted that on Facebook, and everybody south of me said, oh, yeah, we've had them, you know, for the last week or two. It's like, yeah, well, we're in the far north here, so.
That's right. Well, the warm weather from down there is pushing the birds up here that much faster.
Yeah, that's true. So they follow the food, I guess, too. You know, they know where they can eat, and they start heading north. So Canada geese on the way, and I'm sure people are going to see more and more at their bird feeders. Another friend said she saw her first robin in the past week. So, and when the red robin comes, bob, bob, bobbin, you know.
That's right. Usually the early spring bird here in Vermont is the crow. Well, the crows are kind of like the pre-spring arrival.
Yeah.
Then the robin is like, okay, it's really spring now.
That's right. Yeah, the crow, I think they can, they're almost, you know, again, I don't want to slag on that, but they're almost like the cockroach of birds, right? I mean, I think when we're all gone, crows are going to...
Crows are pretty smart.
They're smart and they're hardy, and I think they'll probably outlast the rest of us.
You know, most birds will panic and fly away on the side of the road if a car's going by, but once they figure out where the car's going, where they don't, they're right there on the side of the road. They don't sweat any of that stuff.
I was on a back road in Williston yesterday, and there were five of them in the road, and the guy ahead of me had to actually brake...
they were staring him down.
Yeah, they finally flew off. But I did a good thing yesterday. I had some tires that were never going to see the light of day again. They had tread for just maybe a couple thousand miles left on them. And so I recycled them. And you can go to Chittenden Solid Waste, and I'm sure other counties have this, but $3 a tire. And, you know, they have a recycling area for old tires. So I was happy to get that done yesterday. I also did laundry. I had a really wild, fantastic day off.
A productive off day.
Yeah, it's what you do. You get caught up on things, and it felt pretty great. Oh, and I didn't have to get up at 3:15 yesterday. So
that is nice for sure.
Yeah, it was pretty sweet. All right, we have a little more time here, maybe for a sneaker inner on the open phones here, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. And if you don't call, Lee and I will just chat it out.
Yeah, we'll just while the hour away. And, again, the governor is putting together what he plans to be the vaccine schedule for a good portion out ahead of us.
Right.
So some fairly important information is going to be revealed during our news conference coming up at the top of the hour.
Yeah, so probably not saying that everybody will get they can roll up their sleeves next week, but maybe give a schedule for everybody. Is that what you think?
Well, there's that, and then there's also whether the trends will indicate further turning of the spigot, as the governor, his favorite expression. So
yeah,
we shall see. Moments away.
Ah, normalcy. Just a little bit more of it, right? Yeah, it is. It is exciting each time we're allowed to do something else. Looks like we might have a sneaker in here right before the top of the hour, so they're going to have to be quick. Let's see who we got calling in, maybe from Montpelier. All right, you want to put them right on? Hey, Ray.
Hey.
What's up?
You poetry. Yeah. Years ago, I spent a lot of time in bars because I was a musician playing. And one time during the break, I stopped and went over and got me a beer. And this old geezer was sitting there, and we got talking about poetry.
Yeah.
And his words were, "I like a drink. It calms my nerves. My steadiness improves. And last night, I got so steady, I couldn't even move." Vermont poetry, I don't know where it comes from, but I never forget it. I sat there roaring as I listened to that one, you know.
Oh, I love it. Thanks, Ray.
I just passed along.
All right. It sounds like Ray was probably in Charlie O's to getting that kind of poetry. All right, we're going to shut it down. I want to thank Ray and everybody who called today. That is our show. Vermont Viewpoint is produced by Shayla Connor Shapiro, directed by Danny McGivergan and Lee Cattell today. And we do have the COVID-19 Response News Conference coming up after CBS News. I'm Rick Sengary. I will meet you back here on Monday.